Our next case this morning is Michelbust against the Medical College of Wisconsin. Mr. Kirst.
Thank you, ma'am. Please, the court. In this Title VII retaliation discharge case, the primary decision maker was my client's department chair of 9 years, Dr. Terry. Dr. Terry is the same person who individually and personally also retaliated against my client December 1995, months before she was fired by him. It's the same chair who in the last 14 months of her employment met frequently with the accused sexual harasser, Dr. Mandel, a professor, and went over accusations that he made to him, the decision maker, about ethics violations, about questionable motives, and about academic misrepresentations. It's the same decision maker chair who was constantly kept informed about the EO activities of my client against the accused harasser. It's the same chair, my client's boss, who met personally with Mandel and was aware that Mandel was upset and angry that he was accused. It's the same chair who, behind my client's back, never telling the faculty member in his department and recognizing that the accused harasser, Dr. Mandel, was in a different department, never brought her into any of these discussions. And it's the same department chair, Dr. Terry, who had communications with Dean Dunn on these issues about...
Mr. Kirst, what happened to the contract claim in this case?
We had a state law breach of contract claim, and after summary judgment was granted, we dismissed that with prejudice.
Just
and that is
dismissed
not in the case.
Outright?
Correct. Mm-hmm. As to the decision maker department chair, Terry, MCW, the defendant, has made some light of the fact that he must not have had discriminatory or retaliatory animus against my client because she was promoted less than a year from assistant to associate professor before he was involved in the discharge. In this case, in the deposition of Kathy Sheenan, who is MCW's faculty affairs director, who was employed for 29 years, she testified that at the time of the promotion, she had communications with the department chair, Terry, and he said only negative things about my client, and he did not anticipate that she would be promoted. She was promoted and he signed off, but he signed off in that context and only after the promotion committee and 11 MDs and PhDs had approved her in the rank and tenure committee. So Chair Terry gets no credit, we respectfully submit, for the fact that he signed off on her promotion.
But the relationship with the VA is so substantial that I first of all don't even I don't we didn't get into it, but whether Mandel's alleged harassment took place at the VA or was confined to the college, and because of her research benefit to the college, university, whatever it is, with the VA, once that ended, it would seem that whatever other problems may have existed, her job is no longer possible.
That is correct in part, recognizing, however, that her job at MCW didn't change. Her job at MCW was very limited. It was primarily committee assignments. The year that she was fired, she was selected to be chair of the admissions committee. Kathy Sheenan said, "We have trouble getting faculty on this important committee because it's so time-consuming." So her activities at MCW would have continued had she not been fired by MCW. But it is true the basis for her faculty appointment was research, and it's true that VA, independent of MCW, took that away. But that's why her contract, we believe, is so important, because her contract that MCW gave her for 3 years did not say, if you lose research, your continued employment is in great jeopardy.
So what Judge Easterbrook just said, that was dismissed with prejudice.
Right.
It might have been a perfectly good contract claim. In fact, it looked like a slam dunk contract claim.
I agree, Your Honor.
But once you dismiss it with prejudice, you can't kind of recover the contract claim under some other theory.
No, and we're not trying to recover the contract claim. What we're trying to do is say that under Rule 56C, there's a genuine dispute, and material evidence is the fact that she had a contract. The contract did not say you may lose your job if you lose research. The contract did say the handbook applies.
Now you're just arguing the breach of contract claim.
No, I'm arguing that these facts under the contract are facts, material evidence supporting the fact that the reason they gave is a lie. That these are material facts.
And in the contract claim, we pretty much have to assume that there was no incompatibility between this action and the contract.
No, the contract claim was dismissed for reasons that we didn't want to go to trial in state court on a contract claim. The issues surrounding the contract, had we not brought the breach of contract claim under state law, these issues, and we believe they're paramount and they survived the breach of contract dismissal, these issues are paramount to the way she was treated. Nobody with a contract had ever been terminated under the circumstances she was. They admitted it was unprecedented. The contract refers to the handbook. The handbook says there's a termination section, non-renewal, death, or financial reasons, or cause. And Dean Dunn admitted that none of those apply. He admitted, therefore, the handbook termination sections are inapplicable, and that is, in effect, an admission that they could not get rid of her because she lost research. They got rid of her because she filed charges of discrimination. She did it against her department chair. She challenged them at a faculty meeting, the department chair, to her great dissatisfaction among her peers. It's very courageous for somebody at this level who's been working 15 years with a tremendous career of achievement. She got a high award from Marquette the month she was fired. It was very courageous on her part to do this. Professors, for understandable reasons, rarely do it. There were other occasions she didn't do it because she wanted to survive. She is a very committed research scientist, and that's made evident by what Kathy Sheehan said. Kathy said she was a very serious, committed member of the MCW faculty.
Well, I guess I don't understand. What if MCW had kept her on, what was she making, about $10,000 a year or something?
Yeah, she's making $833 a month.
Okay, so they keep her on, and she basically does administrative stuff that other people don't want to do, I guess. What does she do? Because she's not doing any research. How does MCW have any benefit from this other than doing some tedious jobs?
They have the benefit that they have a successful, having achieved professor, promoted to associate professor, well-known in the community, who's continuing to make a great benefit to our veterans at VA, serving our veterans in physical therapy, which was also part of her training.
Well, that's always VFW.
Right. That was at VA. And before she was doing VA research at VA. So her position at VA was still full-time, same pay, same duties, but it shifted from research to serving veterans in physical therapy. She had a home at both places.
MCW have some definite interest in something besides the research?
I would think that they would have had a definite interest.
Well, I would think maybe, but did it?
Dean Dunn at the VA was chair of the MCW Research Committee at VA, and Barbara Michael Butts have been there for 11 years and would continue to be there. And the record is replete with facts where she said she would continue to look for research. Their loss was, they did not lose, it was de minimis. All of the duties she had with the admissions committee and her other minimal duties at MCW would have continued. They didn't have to pick up her pay. Her pay stayed the same at VA, and she went from research to serving veterans. I see the light is on.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Peirce. Ms. Jones.
May it please the Court, I'm Amy Schmidt-Jones, and I represent the Medical College of Wisconsin in this case. This case really begins and ends with one undisputed fact, and that fact is, on May 12, 1996, at the time the Medical College ended Dr. Michael Buss' faculty appointment, the basis for that appointment had ceased to exist. more specifically, although opposing counsel was talking about her job responsibilities with respect to committees, her job responsibility as a research faculty member was to conduct research, and she testified that she understood her job was to conduct self-funded research at the VA. Now, on May 12, 1996, she had lost all funding. She had lost her lab. The VA had told her she would not be able to compete for future funding. And an important point, she had accepted a job that had no research responsibilities and had no affiliation whatsoever with the Medical College of Wisconsin. Now, Dr. Michaelbus has never argued anything that other than that she's arguing an indirect case of retaliation in this case. That undisputed fact precludes her from establishing even a prima facie case of retaliation because she cannot show at the time her appointment ended that she was adequately performing her job duties. She was not performing research and she had taken a full-time job unrelated completely to the medical college. It's also undisputed in this case that the medical college has never treated someone similarly situated differently. It's an unprecedented event in this case. Given that fact, Dr. Michaelbus also cannot establish the fourth element of her prima facie case, namely that the medical college has treated others similarly situated who did not file a complaint more favorably. This court has held that a failure on any element of the prima facie case requires dismissal, and this case really ends at that point. Nonetheless, I'd like to talk about some of the issues raised by Dr. Michaelbus, in particular this idea that somehow the decision to end her appointment was infected by Dr. Mandel, her alleged harasser. As an initial matter, the record is clear. The decision maker on her termination was not Dr. Terry. The decision maker was Dean Dunn. The termination decision was made by Dean Dunn. That is actually in the plaintiff's proposed findings of fact. Now, the only way Dr. Michaelbus can make out her infection theory is to show that Dr. Mandel actually influenced the termination decision either by providing false information or by concealing relevant information. There is no record, no evidence in this record that Dr. Mandel weighed in at any point on whether the Medical College of Wisconsin should terminate Dr. Michaelbus' appointment. There is no evidence in that regard. Now, with regard to some of the correspondence the counsel has referred to that Dr. Mandel sent to Dr. Terry and then to Dean Dunn, neither letter involved, one is from April of 1995, one is from September 1995, dealt at all with the undisputed events that led to her termination. Neither letter provoked any formal action by the medical college. There was no investigation in connection with either letter. There was no discipline taken. And in fact, Dr. Michaelbus received favorable actions from the college after that correspondence was sent. She was promoted in August of 1995 after the letter was sent to Dean Dr. Terry, and she received a raise at the express direction of Dr. Dean Dunn after the September 1995 letter. Now, the court has raised a very good point here, which is that Dr. Michaelbus has waived her breach of contract claim, and in fact, he never briefed that issue at any point in the proceedings below. For all this talk of what the handbook in Dr. Michaelbus' view didn't require, that didn't require her termination, in fact, it also didn't prohibit her termination. And I would submit, given the facts here, the only applicable termination provision in the faculty handbook is resignation. As of May 12, 1996, she had taken a full-time job unrelated to the medical college that would not allow her to pursue any research. I think it's important to note that Dr. Michaelbus dedicated her academic career to research on veterans' issues. She said the caveat of her research was she needed veterans' patients. She needed to be doing her work at the VAMC. The VAMC had shut the door to Dr. Michaelbus to any future research. For all intents and purposes, when she took a job as a physical therapist, she quit the medical college. The only provision in the handbook that would apply is that dealing with resignation. At various points in this appeal, Dr. Michaelbus has made representations about what the medical college could have done or should have done in this particular situation. All of those arguments really are just a request to this court for the court to substitute its judgment for the judgment of the medical college with respect to what to do with a faculty member who had basically lost the basis to have an appointment. In the end, Dr. Michaelbus is asking this court to overlook an undisputed series of events that started in the beginning of 1996 and ended in May, which eliminated the basis for her faculty appointment and instead inferred retaliation from a complaint that she made 3 years before. This court has found that such a time lag is in fact counter evidence of retaliation. And that's especially the case where here, after the complaint, in the intervening years, the medical college took a number of positive steps toward Dr. Michael Bust. She was promoted, she received a raise in connection with that promotion, and as late as 1995, Dr. Terry, who again was not the decision maker on her termination, was working to move her to an academic department that she thought would be more advantageous to her. Those actions are simply inconsistent with retaliatory intent, and they can't rebut these undisputed events that occurred in the early part of 1996, which was the stated reason for the termination. Dr. Michael Bust testified that in March of 1996, when she accepted the other position at the VA, which had no relationship to the medical college, that she knew her academic status was in jeopardy. Using her words, she said, "That's certainly true. It put my faculty appointment in jeopardy." Given her admission that the basis for her appointment ceased to exist, there's simply no basis to find retaliation in this case. We respect the medical college respectfully request summary judgment be affirmed.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. First?
Mr. Honor, with respect to the university taking favorable action, the decision makers, the chair and the dean, I talked about in my first argument that the chair gets no credit for the promotion. He was against it and merely signed off because I think he was in a corner on that. And as to the raise, I mean, they have in their brief talked about the fact that she got this raise and the decision makers were involved, but if you go to Appendix 155, in January of 1996, Kathy Sheenan writes and says, "You've made a formal complaint of retaliation against you, and we've looked into this," and they basically said that it was in her favor. And it was very serious what Terry did. He basically belittled her request for a raise privately to him and goes to
a
faculty
meeting. Thank you, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.